عليه السلام.
كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
أسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks. So they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And when Ali becomes the embodiment of the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then we can understand why did the Prophet say, An-nazaru ila wajhi Aliyin ibadah. To look at the blessed face of Ali is an ibadah. Because this is no more the face of Ali. This becomes Wajhullah. There's so many narrations by different sahaba on this issue, even from Aisha, where she was talking to her father one day that, you know, I was noticing that you are sitting there in the company of the Prophet. Although the Prophet was there, but you are constantly staring at the face of Ali. What happened? And the father says, you don't know, the Prophet had said, An-nadharu ila wajhi Aliyyin ibadah. I was not looking at the face of Ali. I was doing the ibadah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The first sin committed in human history according to Quran was which one? You will say Qabil. I'm going even further up. Shaitan. What did he do? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala told him to do sajda to Adam and he refused. How did he justify that? He said basically, oh Allah, you are my Lord. You are my Khaliq. You are my Raziq. I only do sajda to you. I'm not going to do sajda to somebody who is even inferior than me. Maybe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala should have rewarded him. Oh, you are a very good muwahhid. No. He becomes a rajim. Accursed. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, even if you want to worship me, you will have to worship me the way I want you to worship. You can't make your own choices in my own ways that this is what I think is better. No, because worship means submission, total submission to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so learn the submission from Ali. When Ali stands on Musalla, he is oblivious of the surroundings. His body is here, but his ruh is at the arsh of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He can actually sense the jamal of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And a question sometimes comes up, what does it mean? Are you saying Ali saw Allah? No, na'uzubillah, we are not doing shirk here. This will be kufr.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid.
I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S., and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Mahmoud was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, White Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanat, Gaza.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife.
Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Shirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and is the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes.
It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, South Korea.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiri, a mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
Ayana Video and her several children, I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather, a severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aid. Bushra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gozad group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S. In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Furiza, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhianne Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Scoos, and Sage Willoughby dubbed the Colston Four celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
They lied, we illuminated history.
And this is the victory for Bristol, this is the victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Oh.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking this fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. military and allied air forces have dropped over 337,000 bombs and missiles on other countries over the last 20 years. That is an average of 46 strikes per day for two decades. Enough. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, Hey, Hey, USA, how many bombs did you drop today? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Pentagon has finally published its first air power summary since President Biden took office nearly a year ago. These monthly reports have been published since 2007 to document the number of bombs and missiles dropped by U.S.-led air forces in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria since 2004. But President Trump stopped publishing them after February 2020. Shrouding continued U.S. bombing in secrecy. Over the past 20 years, as documented, U.S. and allied air forces have dropped over 337,000 and 37,000 bombs and missiles on other countries. That is an average of 46 strikes per day for 20 years. This endless bombardment has not only been deadly and devastating for its victims, but is broadly recognized as seriously undermining international peace and security and diminishing America's standing in the world. The U.S. government and political establishment have been remarkably successful at keeping the American public in the dark about the horrific consequences of these long-term campaigns of mass destruction, allowing them to maintain the illusion of U.S. militarism as a force for good in the world in their domestic political rhetoric. Now, even in the face of the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, they are doubling down on their success at selling this counterfactual narrative to the American public to reignite their old Cold War with Russia and China, dramatically and predictably increasing the risk of nuclear war. The new air power summary data revealed that the United States has dropped another 3,246 bombs and missiles on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, 2,068 under Trump and 1,178 under Biden since February 2020. The good news is that the U.S. bombing of those three countries has significantly decreased from the over 12,000 bombs and missiles it dropped on them in 2019. In fact, since the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Afghanistan in August, the U.S. military has officially conducted no airstrikes there and only dropped 13 bombs and missiles on Iraq and Syria, although this does not preclude additional unreported strikes by forces under CIA command or control. The speed with which the U.S. installed government fell to the Taliban once the U.S. withdrawal was underway confirmed how 20 years of hostile military occupation, aerial bombardment, and support for corrupt governments ultimately served only to drive the war-weary people of Afghanistan back to Taliban rule. Biden's decision to follow 20 years of colonial occupation and aerial bombardment in Afghanistan with the same kind of brutal economic siege warfare the United States has inflicted on Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela can only further discredit America in the eyes of the world. There has been no accountability for these 20 years of senseless destruction. Even with the publication of air power summaries, the ugly reality of U.S. bombing wars, and the mass casualties they inflict remain largely hidden from the American people. How many of the 3,246 attacks documented in the air power summary since February 2020 were you aware of before reading this article? You probably heard about the drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians in Kabul in August 2020. But what about the other 3,245 bombs and missiles? Whom did they kill or maim? And whose homes did they destroy? The December 2021 New York Times expose of the consequences of U.S. airstrikes, the result of a five-year investigation, was stunning, not only for the high civilian casualties and military lives it exposed, but also because it revealed just how little investigative reporting the U.S. media have done on these two decades of war. In a America's industrialized, remote-controlled air wars, even the U.S. military personnel most directly and intimately involved, are shielded from human contact with the people whose lives they are destroying. While for most of the American public, it is as if these hundreds of thousands of deadly explosions never even happened. The lack of public awareness of U.S. airstrikes is not the result of a lack of concern for the mass destruction the U.S. government commits in their names. In rare cases, we find out about, like the murderous drone strike in Kabul in August, the public wants to know what happened and strongly supports U.S. accountability for civilian death. So public ignorance of 99% of U.S. airstrikes and their consequences is not the result of public apathy, but of deliberate decisions by the U.S. military, politicians of both parties, and corporate media to keep the public in dark. The largely unremarked 21-month-long suppression of monthly air power summaries is only the latest example of this. Now that the new air power summary has failed in the previously hidden figures for 2020 to 2021, here is the most complete data available on 20 years of deadly and destructive U.S. and Allied airstrikes. The failure of the U.S. government, politicians, and corporate media to honestly inform and educate the American public about the systematic mass destruction wreaked by their country's armed forces has allowed this carnage to continue largely unremarked and unchecked for 20 years. It has also left Americans precariously vulnerable to the revival of an anachronistic Manichaean Cold War narrative that risks even greater catastrophe. In this topsy-turvy, through-the-looking-glass narrative, the country actually bombing cities to rubble and waging wars that kill millions of people presents itself as a well-intentioned force for good in the world. Then it paints countries like China, Russia, and Iran, which have understandably strengthened their defenses to deter the United States from attacking them, a threat to the American people and to the world peace.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of the program. This series of the program Viewpoints is produced by Brother Mahmoud, an analysis on the thoughts and most important speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers and panelists, religious experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Ali Alevian. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali Alevian, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaykum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, I again thank you for accepting our invitation to this program, Viewpoints. Okay, let's get to the main topic for today as elaborated by Ayatollah Khamenei, Supreme Leader of Iran, a term which is very much controversial, but we want to clarify it for today, and that is, in Farsi, we say Islam-e Nabe Muhammadi, or the pure Muhammadan Islam. So, the main difference between pure Muhammadan Islam and the American Islam and British Islam, according to Brother Ali Alevian, Brother, would you enumerate it again, just the main theme of your speech?
It is actually, it looks for the independence of humanity, human beings, and Muslims, and nations. Second, it is the hope for the the oppressed and the deprived. It is pure Muhammad Islam is based on the teachings of the Holy Prophet and the succeeding Imams that and the infallibles who succeeded the Holy Prophet, based on the teachings of Quran. And it is not something new that has come from, for example, from the skies. No, the same thing that the Holy Prophet actually taught us based on the Quranic teachings and his conduct and seerah and his the conduct and seerah of the Imams after him.
Okay.
In pure Muhammadan, the pure Muhammadan Islam is against the oppressors and tyrants of the time.
Against the tyranny, that's right.
The tyrants of the time. In Islam, in pure Muhammadan Islam, actually, we are defenders of the oppressed and the defenders of the deprived people, whether they are Muslims or non-Muslims. Mm-hmm. And everywhere in the scene of the earth, we see an oppressed. It's our duty to defend the oppressed. In the Muhammadan, pure Muhammadan Islam, we take actually pay attention to both dunya and akhirah, not only dunya. Dunya does not necessarily matter, but we farm our dunya to cultivate in the akhirah and in the next world. So both dunya and akhirah actually matter, but in the opposing viewpoint, actually only dunya matters. Or there are some, for example, even some of them just pay attention to akhirah and actually are inclined towards Rahbaniya and solitude and seclusion. So in pure Muhammadan Islam, actually, we are ready to sacrifice our lives for the sake of God to defend this concept of pure Muhammadan Islam. So we actually define some principles, and there are some still left that we have not yet discussed, inshallah, in some upcoming sessions. We shall give some more criteria to tell our Muslim brothers and sisters.
Right.
These are the actual factors, the criteria that we have for Muhammad Islam. If you agree with them and you actually level them and you know them based on your Quran teachings and Islamic teachings, so we need to follow that.
So
and in case
that's right.
In case we are silent when we see that our brothers and sisters in Islamic world, in Palestine, in other Muslim countries are oppressed and we are silent, so it means that we are not following that view of Muhammad Islam.
That's right. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let me ask you this question. When the Islamic revolution of Iran took place, led by Imam Khomeini, most of the experts and the scholars, religious experts, all across the world have claimed that, and also Rahbar has mentioned it, that this revolution led by Imam Khomeini was somehow reviving the concept of pure Muhammadan Islam. For so many years, more than 14 centuries, the pure Muhammadan Islam was not actualized. And now, based on their opinions, it is going to be actualized in the real world. Why a character like Imam Khomeini could revive this concept? And in fact, this is a bazgash, a return, we can say, or a revival to the pure Muhammadan Islam. What was the difference between Imam Khomeini and the other leaders on that time?
Well, obviously, the main difference was, number one, that Imam Khomeini did not have any constitution for this country. When on his way returning from Paris to Iran, one of the you can say like newscaster, he asked him like, "What's the constitution? Did you made any?" He said it had came 14 centuries ago, and that is Quran. Mm-hmm. So the very first thing that Imam Khomeini has made clear for everyone that the constitution that we will follow is the Quran. In the history, we don't see any revolution or any Islamic government, for example, or battle between. For taking the power, that should be for the Quran. Mm-hmm. For example, we have the different caliphates and the Salatin or the Usmani Emperorship.
Yes.
The Usmani Emperorship, this was all for the for taking the power. It wasn't to impose the, or it wasn't to have the Islamic, you can say, rulership or the rulership of the Quran over the Muslimin.
Okay.
That was the first thing. The second thing is the people, obviously, the scholars, they knew this reality that Imam Khomeini being a leader,
mm-hmm.
obviously, and the rest of the people being the Ummah, they're following one Imam. And that is obviously the pure Muhammadan Islam, because the Quran clearly talks about this concept, the Imam and Ummah.
That's right.
Okay?
Very good.
And the Imam and Ummah means like there is a leader and the rest should follow. If, you know, in front of leader you have different people being a leader,
mm-hmm.
There is no success over
there. So you mean the final step in order to follow pure Muhammadan Islam is following a leader in the society, and this Ummah and Imam is defined in this way?
Yes.
Okay.
And obviously these people, being the nation of that leader, follower of that leader, should know that whether the leader is a pure person or not. Because the main difference between Imam Khomeini and the rest of the people of his time, or even before that, who were talking about the revolution and all those, that Imam Khomeini himself was living a life according to the teachings of Quran.
He himself was an ardent follower of the pure Muhammadan.
Can see in his life, even after he became the supreme leader, he was living in a house that was rented.
Yes.
And he used to give the rent. Usually the leaders, the kings, or the palaces.
That's right.
Obviously, we can see, like, this revolution happened in Iran. Okay. The palace of the kings were there, but he never went to there.
Yeah.
Because he basically... And it goes back to the same thing, like the poor people, the lower class of the community, he tried to live according to them, like them, so that they should not say, like, this person who has taken the rulership, as the prophet, obviously, he was living a life, a simple life, as the poor people used to do. Imam Ali had the same life.
That's why maybe some of the non-Shias were also very much interested in the theology and the thoughts of Imam Khomeini. Brother Ali Alavian.
Yeah.
And we know that the world at that time was divided into two parts, the Western one, liberalism, imperialism, and the Eastern one, communism. So Imam Khomeini, with his own discourse and ideology, introducing the pure Muhammadan Islam, wants to somehow introduce a new framework for the lives and the lifestyle of the people.
And we also see, we also see that when this revolution happened, the very first, like from the Muslim countries, if we take the examples, for example, from Pakistan, we see there was a Jamiat Ulama Ahle Tasannun.
That's right.
There was a group that was leading the whole Ahle Sunnah, and it was its religious, obviously, former group. They first came and they basically gave the congratulations to Imam Khomeini, and they said, "We want such a revolution in our own country." From the India, we had the same thing. So the Muslims of the time, the scholars of the time, they all came.
Freedom seekers all across the world.
But the point is, in Pakistan, if we see they do not have this revolution, was that obviously the enemies, they were working as well.
Okay.
And they propagated that this revolution is not an Islamic revolution, it's a Shia revolution. Mm-hmm. And that's why they backed the Sunnis, we can say, groups.
Okay.
But obviously, on the first place, they knew that the characteristics of this revolution, the characteristics of this leader, is the leader and the revolution, which is the Islamic revolution, and not the Shia.
And the Islamic, we can say, points are highlighted. Brother Ali Alavian, anything to say?
Yeah, in the pure Muhammad Islam, again, I need to mention some other criteria to introduce this Islam to the world, based on the...
of course, this is not the new Islam we are talking about. we are not coining a new religion.
This is our definition of pure Muhammad Islam,
okay,
the term that we have defined. The term that was coined by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, and even was interpreted more by the leader of the Islamic Ummah. In this Islam, as I said, the independence of nations are valued based on the Islamic teachings. No non-Muslim is allowed to overcome and rule on the Muslim lands and to have superiority over Muslims. But I want to invite the brothers and sisters who are listening this voice to see which countries in the Islam world actually are listening and actually under rulership or direct or indirect rulership of the non-Muslims. So this is a good criteria to understand. If, for example, they know the battle of falsehood, the battle of righthood. So which one actually is under the rulership of a non-Muslim? Islam does not allow us to be under the supervision or rulership of non-Muslims, directly or indirectly. So this is one criteria.
Unfortunately, we could see nowadays the Charlie Hebdo magazine insulting our Prophet Muhammad.
And what is the reaction of the Muslim the leaders of this Islam world?
The Muslims are officializing their statement with the Israel.
So this is a good criteria. When we are saying pure Muhammad Islam, this is not something new. It's exactly from the teachings of Quran and the Holy Prophet and the Sunnah and Qawl and Fa'al and statements and narrations and actions of the Holy Prophet, and also the belief that we take from the teachings of the Holy Prophet and his progeny.
That's right.
So in pure Muhammad Islam, knowledge and science is respected. Okay? So we value the knowledge and we respect the knowledgeable people. Not those who are after superstitions and not those who are after extremism. We have a sort of moderation in pure Muhammad Islam. Whatever we do is based on the logic. In pure Muhammad Islam, there is no way to justify the killing and martyrdom and killing of the other Muslim brothers and sisters. Not even Muslims. Even non-Muslims are not allowed to be killed and to be their rights to be violated. While, for example, you are a Muslim and living in a non-Muslim country, even you need to respect their rights. And even if they are in your own land, you need to respect their rights.
That's right.
In pure Muhammad Islam, Islam is the main theme. Mm-hmm. Islam is the master. It does not mean that we violate the rights of others. No, the rights of others will all be respected and will be actually kept in their own rights.
That's right.
But Islam should be master.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And really, actualization of the pure Muhammadan Islam is difficult, and no simple person dares to say that I'm ready or I'm able, I'm capable of doing that.
We should search for these. We should search in the world to see if these criteria are seen, for example, in what nation, in what, for example, country. It's our duty.
Yeah.
Even our silence also, for example, in some cases, is dangerous, and it will actually make us distant from the pure Muhammad Islam.
Okay.
While we see that the oppressed is being the oppressed are oppressed, and we are silent.
Yeah.
So, in the pure Muhammad Islam, we have a duty.
Yeah.
And we have to find where in the world we are and where we are.
This is spirit of search and looking for the truth all across the world, and finding the best model of the pure Muhammadan Islam is also very important. Inshallah, we will dedicate some of our sessions of this program, upcoming ones, to more aspects of the pure Muhammadan Islam, inshallah. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, thank you very much. It was very kind of you. And Brother Ali Alevian, thank you very much too, brother.
Thanks to you, brother.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, I'm the host of the program Viewpoints, Ata, and this series of the programs was produced by Brother Mahmoud. Visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi Amanullah.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, they are guiding me through. Whenever I feel down, lift me up, turning my life around with your love. No matter how rough it gets, I can wear a smile, 'cause your mercy never dries, yeah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.